Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and welcome to Censored. I'm Dr. Lloyd May of Houston.
And I'm Dr. Aoife Vrithnot.
And if you can hear a whirring in your vicinity, dear listener, it's only because we're filming you surreptitiously from under our coat.
And we are not filming each other, though. Definitely not.
But yes, if the hairs on the back of your neck are pricking up, it's because you are being watched. Because today's episode is all about Peeping Tom, Michael Pyle's 1960 proto-slasher-stroke-psychoanalytic kind of, you know, psychosexual drama voyeurism that is just an absolute belter. Like, my God, this was a film that had, you know, not crossed my radar before, and I'm so grateful to you, Aoife, for suggesting it.
I simply suggested it just because I really like Powell and Pressburger, as we learnt in the Blasphemy episode when I talked about Black Narcissus. So it's really because of my kind of obsession with that directorial team. Although this is Michael Powell on his own. At this point, he has split from Emmerich Pressburger. And often in the analysis, Pressburger is talked about as bringing a quite sentimental perspective to these films about Britain that's maybe informed by being a refugee who found refuge in a country after having been, you know, forcibly displaced from Europe. And I think if you take away Pressburger's lovely rose-tinted glasses and you just get Michael Powell going, this is what England can be like and is like. And it's like, whoa, it's a lot creepier than in the double act.
Very much also just like, making films is weird and sordid and violent. Like, I don't know if you know, but I'm a creep for making this and you're a creep for watching it. It's, wonderfully jaundiced sort of perspective.
I mean, yeah, he's been making films for a long time at this point, Michael Powell.
Since the 30s, right? Like decades and decades.
He's been around for a long time. So this is a kind of it's a very meta film. It's about a filmmaking maker making a film, what that does to the filmmaker, what it does to the audience, what it does to the subject being filmed. And at the same time, it's a real thriller. It's a real edge of the seat kind of gripping and magnetic experience. And also when it came out, although Michael Powell was like a very respected figure within British filmmaking, everybody fucking hated it. They slammed it. And it must have been quite a shock to him, I think, because all of his work had been received very well before that. Apparently, according to the main actor, Carl Boehm, at the film premiere, no one came forward to shake their hands after the film had been screened.
Ooh, that's...
Yeah.
And again, a very British diss.
Isn't it? The cold shoulder.
It's sort of doubly interesting because 2 months later, we have Hitchcock's Psycho, which treads, at least superficially, very similar ground in terms of its, you know, narratively, we have a sort of serial killer figure, very soft-spoken, gentle, you know, seemingly not the person you'd expect, engaged in these, you know, sort of psychosexually motivated acts of violence against women, and, you know, where concepts of voyeurism are very much at play. And Hitchcock, you know, we all still know Psycho, you need only play the score for like 2 seconds and everyone, you know, knows exactly what you're picturing. But this did not enjoy that level of, you know, success and ubiquity. I saw discussed that, you know, it was partly because Hitchcock made the decision not to have press screenings of it, so the press couldn't get out ahead of it and be like, this is monstrous, and instead just, you know, sort of turned it loose on audiences. And also, I think, really steered into, like, if you've ever seen the marketing for Psycho, it's very much Hitchcock being like, you know, don't tell anyone the secret, and, like, you know, making you kind of complicit in it. But yeah, no, it is criminal how reviled this film was. And it was really only the good kind of graces of Martin Scorsese that brought it back into circulation, right?
So Scorsese had heard of the film as a kind of this underground classic that everybody talked about, that was sort of something you had to see, but it wasn't easy to watch, obviously, because this is pre-video, so you had to, like, find a special screening. And he became obsessed with the work of Powell and Pressburger in general, and he really, really loved this film. He was, like, hugely into it. And then he started working with Michael Powell's wife, Thelma Shoemaker, as an editor. And so the impetus to recover the film came from the two of them together. They re-released it in the US and everything, but it had vanished because when it received that critical panning, the distributors just pulled it and it just died.
Which obviously, you know, is disastrous and you know, a huge loss for sort of cinephiles, but also does fascinatingly transform the film into a kind of artifact that might circulate within the film, right? You know, this is a film in which our protagonist is making snuff movies, and we, you know, this film becomes almost a sort of snuff movie that can only be, you know, accessed by, like, slightly dubious means, or that circulates in, you know, kind of these sort of fringe forms. Obviously, we've just come from a discussion of video nasties. Here is, you know, a celluloid nasty, right? This is 8mm nasties, you know, and that sense of the DNA of the modern slasher is absolutely here, probably more even than Psycho, right? This, you know, the way that the film is framed, even the kind of, you know, Helen as the sort of last girl, right? The one who, through being more sympathetic and less tainted by the things that our protagonist is, you know, sort of animated by, can you know, make it out of the film alive, albeit scarred. But yeah, oh, it's like, seriously, guys, I know we've been doing this multiple weeks in a row now, but like, go watch this, like, really go watch this.
And it's just out in a 4K restored print, so as a part of the Powell and Pressburger sort of season last year, all of their films were restored and re-released, and also this one. But they couldn't find the cuts that were made to it by the BBFC. So a bit like The Devils, do you remember when they went looking for the cuts made to The Devils in the BBFC? They found some of it. In this case, they couldn't find the cuts that were made so that Powell could get this in 18 cert. So he had to make about 6 cuts, apparently. So what we get to see is not what Powell put together for the censor. But thankfully for me, I got to see what the British censor released rather than the Irish one, because they cut at least another 4 minutes out of it.
Jeez.
And maybe Kevin Rockett thinks maybe 12 minutes out of it.
I just, again, like, like, how can you not see that this is about this material, you know, and about the kind of visual fetishization of violence and fear and terror, rather than a gleeful endorsement of it, you know?
Do you want to know what the Irish Times said about it?
Please.
So in the final paragraph, he writes, "I can find nothing to recommend in this film, which disgusted me as much as anything I can remember seeing. It is hands down the nastiest piece of work of the year and of most other years as well." Nasty. There it is. There's the word.
It's about the nastiness of cinema. Yeah, like, yes, but it's not. It's not. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. Yeah, this is.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, the reception of this.
I mean, that's not unusual. Yeah. That's how the British critics felt about it. It was panned universally. People were talking about sewers.
Yes.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
There was really this deeply visceral reaction. And the word nauseating is interesting, you know, that it's somehow, the film is trying to talk to you about why you are watching a film in the first place. What do you get from it? What are your kicks? Yeah. And obviously a lot of viewers were like, I don't want to discuss that. That's my private business.
Let me sit in this darkened room and, you know, derive pleasure from the depiction of, you know, sexually motivated violence in peace. Thank you very much.
Exactly. It's a private matter between me and my conscience.
Yeah, I mean, to do, I suppose, the sort of necessary synopsis for those who may not have seen it, the film centres on Mark, who is this very quiet, soft-spoken, retiring focus puller. He works in a variety of settings with his camera. So by day, he's a focus puller at a British film studio that I think is probably like meant to be Pinewood or Elmstree or somewhere like that. A focus puller is someone who measures the distance between the camera and the various things that need to be in focus in shot so that you can get the focal length right, which means that he's walking around a lot with like a quite threatening measuring tape, you know, sometimes sort of right up to a person's neck in a way that the film has a lot of fun with. By night, he is a photographer who takes, you know, saucy snaps that are then distributed through a local news agents. And even more by night, he is a voyeur who is engaged in a sort of lifelong documentary project in order to fully capture the terror, the true nature of terror, and particularly terror as it's experienced in the moment of death, particularly terror as it's experienced in the moment of someone witnessing their own death occurring. This is all, it is eventually revealed, all motivated because his father was a psychiatrist who specialized in fear and who basically like just tortured him for his entire childhood as part of a long experiment, and who floats kind of menacingly throughout the background of the film as like, you know, recorded voice and in print and in out of focus footage. And so, yeah, Mark kills his way through a succession of people, including at the start of the film, a sex worker in a long sort of point of view sequence from the perspective of the little cine camera he's carrying. That's a very unsettling sort of sequence. Then the stand-in for the lead in the film, the kind of naff British film that he's working on, and then another model sex worker who he's photographing, and then nearly the love interest Helen, who's his downstairs neighbor in the house that he is the landlord of, who lives there with her blind mother, who's also subject to one of the most like unsettling sequences in the film, because she has Mark's number much.
Yeah, she thinks that the way he walks is suspiciously disconsonant with how he speaks or somehow manifests himself. She's like, what are you doing in that room up there?
Yeah, so he has this apartment above at the top of the building, and there's this sort of small little bedsit room, but then there's his cinema, like his developing room and screening room. And, you know, he's up and the mother sort of says, you know, the blind like live, you know, in the room above them through the footsteps, and his footsteps are stealthy, you know, and that moment where she's like, take me to your cinema. It's like, oh, Jesus Christ. And all, I mean, that, the other thing I think it's worth knowing about this film is that originally Paul and Leo Marx, the screenwriter, wanted to make a film about the life of Freud. So they heard that there was another film in development about Freud's life, I think with Sartre involved. And so they were like, okay, right, well, we can't compete with that. So instead, they just made the most Freudian film imaginable about like scopitophilia and like all this kind of Oedipal sort of tension. Like Helen's bedroom is his mother's bedroom, and, you know, her bed is the bed his mother died in. And, you know, his father, as I say, looms ominously. He also, like, whenever he takes the kind of blind mother, or whenever she makes her way up to his cinema and is basically kind of rumbling him, like, there's a, you know, he contemplates killing her, and then there's a sort of weird sexual charge to, like, her touching his face. Like, it's the whole thing. I mean, you know, it's it's not not nasty, it's but it's about the nastiness.
Yes, it is not a gratuitous, like, I'm doing this for thrills. It's like, why do we get thrills from this? Should we? Like, should we ask ourselves quite profound questions? What really struck me was how much in love with tech it was, with the machinery and Mark's little camera that he carries. Like, he obviously strokes it and everything and
kisses it.
Has a very symbiotic, and he kisses it, and he, you know, it is part of a sexual object for him. But also the way it's shot, we are asked to consider this as a beautiful thing. Mm. And it is cute. Like, it is extremely cute. And his workshop with all of these spinning development wheels, there's this real love affair with the process.
Oh, completely.
And with how gorgeous
and,
it can
and
be.
Like, even just the sort of meta pleasure of, like, making the viewer, you know, privy to the process of filmmaking, right? You know, I mean, we're so deep into the age of podcasts like this and, you know, film bro YouTube that, you know, every motherfucker thinks that they could, you know, make the next, you know, great epic or whatever. And a point you made just before we started recording, Aoife, you know, we all walk around with high-end camera equipment in our pockets all the, you know, we're never separated from our cameras now. Every moment is documentable.
Yeah.
Every frame of our life is, you know, kind of curatable. But yeah, the film, you know, derives interest from sort of being like, this is how a film set actually works. Like, this is what happens, you know, after dark on a film set. There's also this whole idea of detection and detective work as a form of voyeurism as well. Like, it's a matryoshka of voyeurs. Everyone.
And it's also about the way that the different aspects of Mark's work are, you know, public in the sense of working in the film studio. Everyone knows he does that job. And then he goes and takes these, you know, girly nudie pics. And that is hidden from everybody. And the products that, you know, he makes, they are sold under the counter. There's this whole, like, that newsagent is so seedy. And the man who comes in,
who looks like Hitchcock, right?
Yes.
I'm not wrong in thinking that guy was giving really strong Hitchcock energy.
Absolutely. Yeah. That whole scene about how you purchase this illicit material, which is, like, from the point of view of what we know from other sources, completely accurate historically. Mm. That's how it worked. So for people to sit in the audience, they must have been like, oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I like, okay, like, we all know how this works. And you've put this in with the serial murderer cinema maker, like, mind fucking blown. I'd say that is why people were so upset by it.
Yeah, it's very close to home. And it's, yeah, that, I mean, that sequence is wonderful where the guy comes in and he's sort of like, you know, I'll take the Daily Telegraph and the Times. And a friend of mine mentioned, have you any views?
Views.
And he's handed, you know, this portfolio of views, and then a schoolgirl immediately comes in.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
And they're all like, oh yeah, sure, buy your candy, yeah, no problem. And then they go back to talking about,
and then when he buys film. The book or the album, it's placed in a paper bag marked educational books.
Oh my god, like, just the piss take of the censorship system that was working on a daily basis, you know. And yet in the newsagents, there appear to be a lot of scantily clad ladies on the doors, you know, these kind of centerfold spreads from material that isn't banned, obviously. So, like, there seems to be a lot of flesh on display, but yet they want more flesh, illicit flesh, you know. And Mark is there the whole time, standing there, like, listening with this smirk on his face.
It's.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's so good. The film opens, as I say, with, I think you have a establishing shot of Mark making sure his camera is running, or you see the camera sort of, maybe you don't even see Mark yet, you just see the camera in the coat. And then it's all from the perspective of the viewfinder, which has a sort of crosshairs in it. So immediately, you know, everything's in the line of fire of this apprehending camera. But it's this long, very deliberately artificial looking sort of shot. Like the set looks like a set, and it's very luridly sort of colored. I can't remember the name of the film stock they used, but they used a sort of the way they color graded it. It's meant to look as kind of sickly as possible. And you know, it's this long sort of track in on this sex worker who's like, who just turns to cameras like, it'll be £2. And then, you know, and you follow that pretty much unbrokenly up until the moment her look of like kind of resigned and disinterested, like, right, yeah, let's get this over with, turns to horror and freezes in on her terrified apprehension of what's happening. And then you go into the credits, which is just a restaging of this as black and white film being watched by Mark. And it's like, it's just this sense of like, when you pay for a cinema ticket, like, it's the same transaction. And what you're watching now is this, you know, it's so implicating immediately and viscerally. It's good stuff.
I mean, by 1960, people have been watching, especially in the noir genre, you know, they've been watching people suffer on screen in these beautifully lit scenes, you know, where people are dissolving in fear or terror or, you know, so they are very familiar with watching close-ups of people looking miserable and it being the pleasurable experience in cinema. And I say this as a noir fan. I really enjoy noir. But this is, of course, then saying, yeah, but what if we make it really violent?
And I mean, to be fair, it's also the violence is only ever really kind of implied, right? We eventually see, just to, again, for the benefit of listeners who haven't seen the film, what it transpires is happening and, you know, has produced this similar sort of signature facial expression on everyone who's been murdered, which is what links these cases together. It basically transpires that Mark has like rigged up a sort of massive reflecting sort of dish on the camera so that the prospective victims are watching themselves react to their own impending death as he approaches toward them with one of the legs of the tripod of the camera extended forward with a blade on it. So he sort of impales them on it as they watch themselves be impaled as he documents that happening. And again, in terms of the way that this is like self-indicting, like, what did you make of the fact that it was Moira Shearer who plays the stand-in, right?
Yeah, because Moira Shearer is the lead actress in The Red Shoes, which is Powell and Pressburger's really big film from a few years earlier, who, you know, suffers and dies for her art. And she dances again just before she dies.
Yeah, has.
And you're like,
has this elaborate dancing.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Because she's this incredible, like, stunningly beautiful, incredible ballerina, you know, really strong dance background. And The Red Shoes obviously, you know, hugely kind of leverages that and is the film that, like, makes her name, catapults her to stardom. So I'm just fascinated by the experience of being cast by the people, you know, by the person who, like, made a star of you to play someone who wants to be made a star of by a filmmaker whose method of like making you a star is to like make you the center.
Is to murder
and to murder you.
You
in a highly staged way. So like, you know, he gives her her mark, which is even his name, right? You know, like Mark, I'm sure there's a kind of, you know, deliberate sort of pun there. But, you know, stand there over this, you know, trunk into which the corpse will be put. And it's, you know, like, just It, you know, fascinating stuff.
I mean, as a director, he's really turning the camera into his own soul and into his relationship with the films that he has been making by casting someone who he filmed previously, you know, as the lead actress. He's like, I mean, it's an incredibly elaborate and clever system of commentaries that interrelate.
I mean, it's obviously, you know, it's impossible to talk about this film without talking about sort of Laura Mulvey and, you know, like visual pleasure and narrative cinema, that famous essay that originates the concept of the male gaze and that, you know, sort of offers this psychoanalytic account of the ways in which, you know, there is a sort of latent murderousness to the way that the gaze operates in a Lacanian sense in cinema, and how, you know, a masculine coded perceiving eye drives pleasure from watching feminine subjects reduced to objects of aesthetic pleasure through death. And, you know, it's like, yes, this film fully understands that that's what's happening.
Absolutely. One of the things that Scorsese finds so amazing about it is that it's about the obsession of the filmmaker as well. This consistent need to repeat the same thing over and over again because the lighting isn't right, or it's just not quite right. Like, in a way, it's so grimly funny when Mark looks at the film of his latest killing and he's like, no,
the light fades too soon.
It's just, you know, it's technically imperfect. And it links very well to the beginning when, you know, the main actress that they're making this film, that Moira Shearer might stand in for at some point, you know, they ask her to faint over and over and over like 20 times and she can't do it right. And in the end, she really faints. And they say perfect.
Yeah, she faints through. Yeah, it's very Kubrick, you know, that all the stories about Shelley Duvall on the set of, you know, The Shining, and that, yeah, that sense of like running something through over and over again. There's also, even preceding that, there's a very funny moment where, you know, the kind of executive producer, like someone higher up in the sort of studio, is like, right, just from here on, right, we're massively over budget, we're screwed, so from here on, the minute you get a good take, just go, like, no retakes. And then, just to really cap it all, there's obviously then that joke recurs whenever this actress, who's, you know, had the trauma of discovering her double murdered in a, you know, in a trunk in this kind of comedy scene, who then, upon opening the trunk, faints dead, and the director's like, the silly bitch, she's fainted in the wrong scene. So, yeah, there's, you know, there is a sort of weird, like, again, very sort of impish, but in a slightly kind of unsettling way, levity to some of this. Like, it's also a quietly very funny film.
I really enjoy, because, of course, it makes you even more complicit in the experience of being the audience member who's enjoying being manipulated. It's, yes, I am enjoying this very much.
And there's so many moments that kind of own that, like, you know, Helen, the denouement of the film is precipitated in part by Helen, the love interest, going up to Mark's cinema whenever he's not there and watching what he's got on the camera or on his projector laced up, which is the murder of the, you know, the last victim. He finds her watching it and she's like, that was just a film, right? Just tell me what I saw, that was just a film, you know? And this sort of self-exculpating, you know, audience reaction of like, but this is fine because it's not real, right?
Even it's staged, isn't it? Yes, it's staged, but it's also real. Oh my God, how do you draw the lines between them?
Also, just to round off the kind of jokes about filmmaking, I think for my money, the funniest moment for me as a, you know, kind of wanky cinephile is, as he's as the police are breaking into the building to come and arrest him, and as he's just about to take his own life as the kind of culmination of this, you know, documentary project he's been engaged in, Mark smashes a window and the police are like, oh God, you know, they think they're under fire or something. And he smashes a window because he's just trying to grab coverage Like, he just wants to get kind of snatch as much footage as he still can of them, like, coming to get him. And so it's the spirit of, like, you know, you can see how this resonates with the experience of, like, the frantic filmmaker who never has enough time and just has to get all the B-roll you can while you can. Like, even as you are about to stage manage your own, like, murder suicide.
You're like, quick, I just need to get this shot.
Just, like, stealing shots. It's so funny.
What I found really fascinating, so Mark's camera in his hand, which mimics our permanent attachment to our cameras now, has created, of course, that he has the camera in the head. Like, he sees everything through his camera. And if that isn't all of us right now, I don't know what the fuck is. Like,
yeah.
We are, even if we're not recording or photographing, we are thinking about it and we are wondering, possibly, could we do it later, or is now the right... Like, it never stops.
No, it's the society of the spectacle, you know, kind of writ at its largest. The way in which he kind of, you know, culminates his project is he has rigged up this, you know, the entire length of the cinema room, the screening room, with cameras on tripwires so that he can document, like, frame by frame, him running to impale himself on the, you know... leg of the thing. Like, it is really so anticipates that kind of hypermediation, you know, everything must be documented, it's that sort of Baudrillardian kind of idea of hyperreality, that we experience everything now as sort of simulation, or as imagined, as if it's being observed through, you know, a kind of narrative framing. And yeah, it's, you know, and it's doing this in like 1960, like, it's
1960. I mean, it's so evergreen to watch it now. The part where Mark, as the young child, he shows films of his childhood that his father made and show him being tortured in the name of trying to work out what fear might look like or feel like in some experimental, ethically dubious, insane concept. But, you know, like, so many of us are mining our relations for content.
And do you know who plays the child in that footage?
Yeah. Yes, it's Michael Powell himself and his own son, yeah. Columba. And one of the things that really upset people was that he was using his own child in these scenes, even though they are acting. You know? The critics were so caught up in the emotional reaction to the film that they're like, well, this is too real. This is too fucked up. You should not use your own child as an actor in this context. It's like, why though? Like, why really? You know, it's the most profound commentary he could probably come up with for what he does as a director.
The kind of Freudian dynamics of it. There's a point where, you know, Helen, wants to go on a date with Mark, and it's kind of like, you know, points out that he's still bringing his camera with him. And he's like, you know, can you bear to be parted from it? The thing she says is, you know, it's practically become an extra limb. And, you know, I think we can guess which limb we're meant to assume it's a kind of prosthesis for. And the way that in the sequence with the mother, where she's up, you know, kind of finding her way through this screening room with the stick, her cane has the same sort of bladed as the blade of the leg of the tripod. So it's, you know, this scene in which the cinema is this space of like blindness and darkness, but also kind of illumination, in which all of these kind of prostheses of vision sort of duel with one another as, like, you know, sort of prosthetic surrogate sexual extension. Like, it's It's so good.
It's so fucking good. And Mark ends up, his first camera is given to him by his father. So, like,
he's told he has his father's eyes by the psychiatrist, who he asks if he can cure him of his scopidophilia. Like, it's, you know, just great stuff. Also, tiny sidebar. I was, you know, today years old when I learned that apparently the kind of correct way to pronounce memo is memo.
Oh, is that the correct way? I assume so.
Because your man in the studio head is like, take a memo. And I was like, what? I'm sorry?
Maybe that's how the word started out and everyone was like, I mean, it makes sense. Yeah. But
also, I love the way it plays with genre sometimes. Like, with the whole sequence with Vivian, who's the stand-in, you know, played by Moira. I love that she thinks she's in a comedy and she doesn't know she's in a horror, right? You know, she's doing her, like, dance stuff. Like, she thinks she's in a previous Paulin Pressburger film. And, like, it's, you know, there are quite a few different points where other characters are kind of, you know, behave like the Millie, I think her name is, you know, one of the models who he photographs. Like, you know, she's bantering away with him and being quite quick-witted. And it's like, no, 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 baby, you're not. That's not the film you're in. I'm sorry. Get out.
No. That was one of the major cuts that the censors made both in Britain and Ireland, was when Millie is being, she's the model for these sexy nudie pics that Mark is making. And she says, can you shoot me so that you don't see the bruises? In the version I watched, I saw no bruises on her whatsoever, even though it isn't from Mark's point of view. It's a wide shot. And they were cut. So there was must have been some point at which she kind of went,
she,
you know, here's my shoulder, because her boyfriend beats her.
It's one of those moments that begins like light comedy and then gets really dark. So she's sort of like, you know, I was out on a date last night. She says, I'm going to be married next week, you know, and that I need to get back to my boyfriend or something. But basically, you know, it rapidly becomes clear that the boyfriend is not the fiance. And, you know, like, we ran into my fiance. And then she's like, so can you shoot this so the bruises don't show? So it's like, you know, sex comedy. And then it's like, no, domestic violence. There's Lorraine, I think her name is, the woman who's framed, you know, very intriguingly and like, you know, in silhouette, in profile. And, you know, we're told, it's her first time. And then she turns, you know, dead onto the lens. And we see that she has a quite prominent facial scar from a sort of hair lip. And Mark is utterly seized and arrested by it. And this kind of, just the way that the film is constantly like, the pleasures of cinema, the safe pleasures of cinema, constantly kind of about to be disrupted, or just suddenly you're needled with something.
I love the way it does make us all feel, because of it lifting the veil on how film, how it's made, how it's staged. Like, you become the peeping Tom, like, secretly working out, so that's what they do. And, you know, it is absorbing in that sense. You can't help be like, I'm really interested to know, was that how it worked?
And also just the fact that it's like, you know, there is a continuity between all of these modes, right, in terms of the agents involved, in terms of the mechanisms of their production, right? We might want to treat mainstream cinema as distinct from, you know, the production of like sort of scuzzy pornography, as distinct from the writing of children's books about magic cameras, which is obviously what Helen's writing. But actually it's like, nope, these are all interconnected. They are all versions of the same. They exist on a continuum. And you can't pretend that you're like better than this.
And I feel like that's where we have arrived now that we all have our cameras. Like, we are at the place where Michael Powell was trying to say we already were, you know, in the 60s. He's like, this is where we are. And it is now unavoidable that we are all producing film image of ourselves, of our children, monetizing them on YouTube, putting them up on Facebook, like all of it. It is the most prescient film about technology.
And sure, we wouldn't be at any of that crack. You know, we wouldn't be, you know, elaborately restaging 1940s Hays Code satirical imagery or anything. You know, we're innocent of all of this, listeners, and that's why you're listening to this, is because we don't feel any necessity to document or monetize our interest.
None whatsoever. Yeah.
Tune in next week.
Oh my god. For more monetizing of your personal interests. And obsessive documenting of our reading and watching histories.
If you didn't see it happen, how do we know we exist?